Possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with 2004-2005 season musical performances by jazz greats Herbie Hancock, Michael Brecker, and Roy Hargrove, pianists Ivo Pogorelich and Richard Good, singers Nathan Gunn and Don Upshaw, and the Chicago and Prague Symphony Orchestras. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and our technical director, Henry Frain. George Washington remains justifiably famous for at least two of his great roles in our history, leading the Continental Army during the American War of Independence and serving as the first president of the United States. But there's another chapter in his life story we barely remember, and it's much entwined with the American narrative itself. At the time when travel and communication moved at the speed of water at best, the United States was a nation only in theory. George Washington's idea was to unite the states and territories by forging a passage to the continental interior, and believed the most natural avenue for this passage flowed past his home at Mount Vernon, the Potomac River. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about this little-known part of the story of George Washington and how his dream played out in our history. Our guest is the writer Joel Achenbach, staff writer for The Washington Post. He's the author of five previous books, including Captured by Aliens, It Looks Like a President Only Smaller, and Why Things Are. His latest book is entitled The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West, published just a month ago by Simon & Schuster. We'll talk with Joel Achenbach about The Grand Idea during this hour. And as we do, we invite you to join in the conversation. If you have questions, those are welcome. All you have to do is call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line if you're listening outside of Champaign-Urbana, anywhere in the Midwest here if you're listening on the air, or if you're listening online anywhere in the continental U.S., the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. And Joel Achenbach joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Hi, Jack. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you. And I really liked what you said about how this book is, this story of Washington and the Potomac is entwined with the American narrative. That's a great phrase, and that's how I viewed it, too, that it's, although I focus on the Potomac, it's really about America itself.
Indeed. Well, and the book is full of great phrases and great writing, by the way. It really is a great read.
Oh, you're kind to say so. I did my best. I tried to make it a well-written book. I labored over every sentence and every paragraph, and it was a lot of fun, though. I learned so much about American history that I didn't know, and that I hope that when people read it, they'll say, as some people have already said to me, gosh, I just never knew that stuff.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you, what set you on the trail of this part of George Washington's life?
You know, this may be kind of a strange answer, but I wander a lot down to the river. I live near the Potomac River in Washington, D.C., in the northwest part of the city. And when I bought my house about a dozen years ago, I always thought it was kind of neat that there was this bluff, and down below the bluff was the river. And I, over the years, more and more, I've become kind of a great rambler along the Potomac. Mm-hmm. And there are stories there. You can sense it when you walk down, particularly in the wintertime, when you can see all the old ruins of mills and houses and things. And, of course, along the Potomac, we have this canal, the C&O Canal, the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. And over the years, I thought, you know, there's got to be a book here somewhere. And I did not realize when I got into it the extent to which George Washington would become the focus of the book. I mean, this is, it's not exactly a biography of Washington. It's really Washington and his scheme for the river. But he was Mr. Potomac.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of great stories in the book, and there's no way we're going to get to all of them, but maybe we can at least sketch the outlines and encourage people to read more if they'd like to know more. So let's dive in. I guess the book begins after the War of Independence. George Washington seemed ready to settle into retirement at Mount Vernon, and he certainly had enough there to keep him occupied.
Yeah, he says, I'm done. I've done my service to the country, and he certainly had. For 8.5 years, he'd been fighting the war. So he goes home on Christmas Eve, 1783, and he tells everyone, I've retired to the banks of the Potomac under my own vine and fig tree. And certainly at that point in American history, which is sort of the beginning of the United States history, because the ink was hardly dry on the Treaty of Paris, which gave to the United States this vast territory going all the way to the Mississippi River. At that point, there was no constitution, there was no presidency, there was no obvious role for Washington, and he was happy to be retired. But you learn a lot about someone in their downtime, when they don't have to play an official role. And what happens with Washington is that after 8 months of trying to get his estate, his plantation, in order, he gets on a horse and he takes off on really a remarkable road trip that forms the sort of backbone of my narrative, is this road trip he takes starting in September of 1784.
And that road trip was, I guess, a couple of purposes. One was he owned a lot of land that he wanted to visit that he hadn't been to for in some cases, a decade or more.
Yeah, and he, this is an interesting thing. He has, we're so focused today on conflicts of interest. And certainly Washington in that period had a major conflict of interest, which is, I'm not saying that critically, he has two overlapping concerns. One is, he is worried that the whole experiment of the United States is going to fail, that the country is going to fall apart. The centrifugal forces are so powerful. It's like 13 separate countries loosely confederated. The Articles of Confederation don't really give Congress much power. Every state is essentially a rival to every other state, and that's one of the sort of subplots of the book, is this race to the West. It's kind of a contest between Virginia, Pennsylvania, and New York State to see which of these powerful states are going to become are going to seize the trade of the West, seize the commerce of the West. Washington is concerned that the West, and by that, where you are would have been considered the far West.
Right.
The West would be anything beyond the Appalachian Mountains, which that includes western Pennsylvania, parts of what are now West Virginia, and certainly Ohio, Kentucky, everything along the Ohio River Valley that's sort of drained by the Ohio River. And that everyone knows that this area is being rapidly settled, that tens of thousands of people, month by month, are pouring through the gaps in the mountains and hacking out homesteads in the woods, many of them not really buying land. They're just squatting on land. Now, Washington has title to tens of thousands of acres of western land. So he's making this trip partly as a business trip to look at his own property and collect rent and get in the face of some squatters who he knows are on his property. But he also has this larger national interest, which is he wants to figure out a way to make sure that the West stays in the orbit of the Atlantic states, that he doesn't want the West to become a breakaway republic. We take it so for granted today that America is a single nation, but that was not an obvious outcome in 1784. There was very real possibility that you could have a new country develop in the Mississippi Valley, and there could even have been a civil war someday between that country and the United States to the east.
Yeah. Well, as you say, many Americans didn't yet consider themselves Americans.
Right. Why should they? I mean, a lot of them didn't even speak English. They were Germans or Dutch or Finns or Swedes certainly there were a million Americans who were kidnapped Africans or the descendants of those Africans. You did not have any of the homogenizing forces that we see in the country today. And you had a not inconsiderable population of indigenous people who had their own interests and their own ideas about what should happen to the land, and who were, in many cases, very fiercely resisting the invasion of the West. So the Indians were a part of this whole mix, and the West was up for grabs. People were conscious of the vastness of the territory. I mean, where you are, and where going up to Michigan, Wisconsin, all that is all part on paper part of the United States of America, And the question is, what was going to happen to it? Who would control it? What would be the political future of that vast territory?
So George Washington's idea was that by crafting a corridor of transportation and travel for goods and, you know, market, you know, relationships and so forth, and just being able to traverse this territory in a reasonable way, that would unify or at least give people a greater sense that there was a nation building here.
Washington was the ultimate realist. He knew that having nice documents like the Declaration of Independence, for example, it was not going to keep people bound together, that people were not sentimental, that they acted based on their personal self-interest. And among other things, that would mean how could they sell their products? How could they sell their grain, their furs, their lumber, you know, coal, you know, anything that they managed to extract from the earth, how are they going to sell it? Now, in that period, you had the Spanish, still a formidable presence, even though the empire had declined a lot. They had New Orleans, and they had closed the Mississippi River to commercial traffic by the Americans. So the Spanish were still out there. They controlled all of the Louisiana Territory. And they controlled Florida and New Orleans. The British were still up in Canada. Washington was afraid that the Westerners would essentially fall into the orbit of the British or the Spanish, or somehow not feel a connection to the East. So he looked at the Potomac flowing by his mansion, and he said, "This is an arm of the sea. It goes way up into the interior," and he had paddled it and knew that the Potomac had these water gaps through the mountains at places like the Blue Ridge, Sidling Hill, Savage Mountain. These are places where the river just slices right through the mountains. If you've ever driven around the Appalachians, you know there are these water gaps. There's a Delaware water gap up in New Jersey, for example, that's a famous one, where the river kind of slices perpendicular to the mountains, as though there's acid in the water, and it just has carved a niche. And so Washington's, what he wanted to do on this trip was find the shortest portage route from the headwaters of the Potomac to the headwaters of the Ohio River. That was the goal, and that thereby to help create a commercial avenue, kind of a corridor across the mountains linking the West and the East.
And we wouldn't need the Mississippi at all, actually, at that point.
He really kind of liked the fact that we couldn't use the Mississippi. He did not want the Spanish to open the Mississippi to cargo because he thought that would defeat the long-term goal of national unity. Washington was, I mean, the project of his life, and I think actually the new book on Alexander Hamilton puts it really well, that Hamilton, too, the project of these people's lives was creating a strong government, a strong national union, creating a country that would last. And so for Washington's reading of the landscape said, if the Mississippi remains closed, then the people in the West are going to have more of an incentive to do their business with the people in the East. Now, if you look at a map, and I don't know how well the listeners out there know the geography of all the rivers of the East and the Great Lakes and everything, but there are several ways to get from the West to the Atlantic Ocean. One is down through the St. Lawrence River, but that's going through British Canada and is very far to the north, and to Washington's eyes, that was way too far north. It would freeze too early in the fall and thaw too late in the spring. So that was not a good water route, he didn't think. Then you had the Hudson River, which up near Albany, it is joined by the Mohawk coming in from the west. That route is the route that eventually became the route of the Erie Canal. Washington knew that was a good route to the west, potentially, but also thought it was too far north and that it was just too roundabout to get to the Tidewater. And so he thought the best route was the Potomac.
You say Washington subscribed to the idea of providence. What was this idea?
He was religious. He believed in God, but I think that, and I think he believed, he, you know, he wasn't a big churchgoer. He was not a, he wasn't big on on dogma and doctrine and all that, but I think he believed that first of all, he had a role to play. That destiny had chosen him to play a special role in the country. And why shouldn't he believe that? So many times he'd been exposed to incredible peril and had survived. It was as though he were indestructible, as though he had been chosen to play some historic role. But he also, I think he was one of the first to say the United States could be a really grand country. You know, my book is titled The Grand Idea, in a direct reference to his Potomac plan, but the grand idea is also the grand idea of America, and America as this potentially powerful country that, because of geography, had been put in a position to be independent of the great powers of Europe. And he said, "Hey, you know, we're in a position, because of geography, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but to basically become, you know, a really special place for human beings and for enlightenment to flower." And he was right about that. I mean, you know, his Potomac plan, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, his Potomac plan didn't work out exactly like he wanted
right.
to, but the country became something. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, we have our problems, and we've had our troubles and our tragedies, and a lot of bad things have happened in American history, but I think it's a great country, and I think this story shows one of the early chapters and how it got to be that way.
Mm-hmm. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking during this hour, Focus 580, with Joel Achenbach. He's the author of the book we're discussing, The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West. He's also a staff writer at the Washington Post. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about the idea of wilderness in these times. It was a very different idea to Washington and most other Americans, something to be tamed. Wilderness was actually abhorred.
Absolutely. You know, today we're focused on trying to preserve roadless areas, and there's actually a big debate in Washington in recent years about whether we can build a bridge over the Potomac. You know, we're concerned about the effects of overdevelopment. But in the 1780s, the concern was underdevelopment or lack of development, or more specifically, if you're George Washington and you've traveled around the country for 8.5 years fighting the war, and he was an incredibly well-traveled, widely traveled person, he knew it was just impossible to get anywhere. Not impossible, but it was hard. I mean, there were no bridges over any major rivers in America, not one. The roads were boggy, linear mires of goo. Essentially, if you tried to use a road, that if it rained any time recently, it would just be a long mud puddle, because the wagon wheels would slowly turn everything to mush, and you know, the roads were choked with stumps, and often, if they were maintained at all, would be by a local farmer who might be in charge of it. But, you know, there's no federal government, certainly, to build an interstate highway, the states weren't big on road building. And so it was hard to get anywhere. And, you know, this is something that he's focused on, is the wilderness, which you ask about. If you stood on a bluff and looked out over the woods, the eastern forest, I actually wrote a piece about this in National Geographic a couple of years ago. The eastern forest extended roughly the size of France. I mean, this is the famous line is that a squirrel could go from Maine to Georgia without ever touching the ground. That's probably apocryphal, but, you know, the extent of the woods was one of the great biological wonders of the world. Mm-hmm. And so if you stood on a bluff and you looked out over this ocean of trees, you could not imagine that the resource would ever be exhausted. And what Washington wanted, and what a lot of people wanted, was to find some way to transform this into a usable resource, a place that could be inhabited. I mean, a place where there was sunshine reaching the ground.
And actually, that was one of the things. It was so dark that you know, it was a kind of a scary place to people, or you know, it sort of had a different emotional meaning to people than.
Yeah, it had. People got their fill of, you know, of camping. they it's not like, you know, hey, let's get away from it all and
right.
go out to the woods. No, they were out there thinking, you know, how are we ever going to get some flour to make some decent, you know, bread? How are we going to, how, you know, there was plenty of meat in the woods. I mean, because there's so much game. I mean, there was, and I remember at one point I came across a story about one of the early exploratory parties going through what became Kentucky, and they talked about all the game they killed, and they killed like 83 bears, you know, something unbelievable number of bears. You know, it's just hard to imagine. And of course, that sounds like a real slaughter. But you know, it was in the old days, there were bison in the eastern forest, and there was elk, and certainly there were wolves and panthers and all kinds of creatures. I guess maybe not panthers, but cougars.
Mm-hmm.
To me, a panther and a cougar are sort of the same thing, but I think it's actually a cougar.
Not too many either around anymore, you know.
Yeah, they're not. They're all gone, you know. But a lot of them are gone. But you know, it was a completely different sort of experience. And Washington wanted to impose order on this very chaotic situation. I mean, one of the things that I try to bring out is his personality. He's brave. He's industrious. He's energetic. But man, he sure does like order. He does not like. He's not a big fan of the rabble, the ruffians, the lower classes of people, who he views as not always going along with the program he wants. He can be very imperious, and he definitely doesn't like the ones who he thinks are trying to rip him off by squatting on his property and not paying rent. So
That's a very interesting part of the story. You detail his dealings with a group of people that you call the seceders.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were squatting on his land. And this is part of, you know, sort of going down the story of the grand tour that he took. Out in this wilderness, the rule of law was very much a question. And one of the big questions was who owned the land. Well, he certainly wanted to assert that the land that he had title to, he was going to claim. And that he felt that that was an important sort of method of asserting the rule of law and maybe asserting the identity of the nation.
Well, absolutely. I think the reason I did this book, you asked me at the beginning why I did, and I said, mm-hmm. I went down the river. But when I picked up Washington's diary, I started investigating Washington and the Potomac, and I read his account of this trip. What jumped out at me was that he has this very difficult face-to-face encounter with the squatters, and they stand up to him.
Mm-hmm.
They defy him. And although I'm not an academic, I'm a newspaper reporter and an explanatory journalist, and I write a lot of explanatory type things. But fundamentally, I'm not a scholar. You know, I'm not an academic. But the academics these days are quite interested with the questions of who had power. And here is something that's a really wonderful piece of low hanging historical fruit, so to speak, where you have the most powerful person in the country having a direct encounter with some of the least powerful and most marginalized figures on the frontier, and it's almost too good to be true. I mean, don't you read this? And I think that I would be really interested to see, you know, what a university professor might say of this whole situation. And I tell the story, and it's kind of hard to pick sides. I'm really sympathetic to the seceders because they've gone into the woods and hacked out a life for themselves and built their barns and raised their kids, and they're doing their best. And out of the blue comes this absentee landlord, the most famous American of all, riding up, you know, just unexpectedly. Actually, I think they knew he was coming because there was some warning. But he shows up one day and says, you know, you got to pay me. I own this land. And they say, no, you don't own this land. So I'm sympathetic to them. On the other hand, here's this guy George Washington who left home for 8.5 years. He liked Ming at Mount Vernon. He did not want to be out tromping around fighting the war for 8.5 years. He did this wonderful service to his country. He made this country, and these people, in his absence, when he doesn't have time to look after his own estate, they squat on his land. So he was outraged by it, and I think that he had some reason to feel like he was being ripped off.
So what happened?
So what happens is they have several meetings, and they lay out each other's positions. They can't agree. The squatters say, we don't think you really have a legal title to this. He says, I do have legal title. They say, I'll tell you what, they say, we'll buy it from you. And he says, okay, well, this is how much money I want. And they go, we can't pay that, but we'll pay a lower amount. And he says, no way. And they say, well, okay, then you're going to have to sue us. And he asks them, and there's some legends that supposedly he cursed and he was fined, you know, 5 shillings on the spot for cursing. And it's hard to substantiate that story. And there was another story that Washington held up a handkerchief and said, I will have this property as surely as I hold this handkerchief in my hand. And that's also probably apocryphal. But what's certain is he made every one of these squatters stand up directly and say, yes, I will stand for a lawsuit. And they did. One by one, they defied George Washington, which is a very sort of, you know, brave thing that they did. I guess that's the right word. And so for 2.5 years, a little over 2 years, this lawsuit drags on until finally, and Washington is vigorously drafting memos to his lawyer saying, do this, do that. And he goes off looking for paperwork to support his claim, but eventually he wins, and all these families, 13 families, are driven off his land, you know, by court order.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we include them in our conversation?
Sure.
Let me just mention again, we're talking with Joel Achenbach about his book, The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West. We have one caller waiting, and if you'd like to join us, you can too. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Caller on line number 4 in Charleston. Good morning.
I hardly know where to begin. The upshot of what your guest has been saying and the wide view of history indicates to me that the new bourgeois paradigm of capitalism and all the ramifications of that as what has ensued from independence and then competition with England and the rest of the Western European powers, much, much to the degradation of ordinary people, especially Native Americans, and the continuing rape of the land, and the capitalist paradigm, you know, is driving us to extinction, I'm afraid, because what has happened from 1776 and all the wars in between, the westward expansion, which was nothing more than a land grab, and Washington's hand in all this, and then the revolution in France, you know, which then agreed on the same tactics and the same common philosophy, now has taken us into the 21st century. And look where we're at right now, this very minute, with the whole of the Middle East in flames over oil. What we can't get here, then the neo-colonialists then head off across the ocean with huge armaments and military to get what they want by any means necessary. And that beat goes on.
Let me answer that just for a second to the best that I can. I think the caller has really hit something, the nail on the head here in a sense, in that if you want to know how the world got to be the way it is today, my book looks at, you know, a chapter in that, and he says, well, the Western expansion was a land grab. Absolutely true. It was a land grab. He says the Western expansion led to the extermination of the Indians. That's true, and I deal with that in the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's something that I wrestled with a great deal, because the race to the West has direct consequences time and time again for ordinary people, whether it's the Indians or the slaves or the Irish workers who ended up building the canals. You know, there's no doubt that as the caller puts it, the capitalist system has this rapacious quality. On the other hand, it's not clear to me what other system the caller would like to impose. I mean, I think that Washington, although he never used words like capitalist, in a sense he was a classic capitalist, my assertion earlier is something I believe. I do believe this is a great country for all of its flaws. And I think most people think that. But I think even most people who are uncomfortable with some of the excesses of our system and who are uncomfortable with what's happened in the Middle East would also say it's still a great country. And I hope that if you were to look at the book, you would see that I've tried to fairly look at both the positive and the negative.
Can I answer a bit for a second?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, your guest asks, what other system would we have? The continuity of political and economic ideals has escaped your guest because the Marxism is not dead. Yet how is it possible that we can say communism is dead when it's never been an actual social paradigm?
Let me interrupt the caller. I don't want to get into a big debate about capitalism versus communism because that's out of my league, number one. And my book doesn't really address Marxism. I appreciate your call. I do think that you've raised the whole issue, which I think everyone should think about, which is the consequences of this headlong, race to the West and how it actually affected various types of people.
I appreciate the caller's point as well, but it's not really something that we can spend a lot of time talking about during this hour. Certainly it is an issue that I hope we take up in a number of ways on this show. So let's move on, and I appreciate your answer to that as well. I wanted to sort of back on the narrative thread here. After the Grand Tour, Washington returned to Mount Vernon and set about articulating his vision for this Western Passage via the Potomac and then getting it funded.
Right. He comes, after he has his encounter with the squatters, he goes through the backcountry for several hundred miles and gets home, and he immediately writes out this treatise on how very plausible it is to turn the Potomac into a corridor to the West. And he then sends letters to all of his political allies and friends and associates and says, look, we can really make this thing happen. We can make the Potomac a much more navigable river. And so he starts something called the Potomac Company, gets it funded by the states of Virginia and Maryland, and the first thing they have to do is they have to start digging canals, and they start digging a really heroic canal around Great Falls, which is the 76-foot drop over the course of about half a mile in the Potomac, maybe a dozen miles northwest of Washington, D.C. today. At that time, there was no Washington, D.C., so I guess you'd say northwest of Georgetown. So they start digging a canal there, and more canal work near Harper's Ferry, and they start pulling rocks out of the river to try to smooth the flow of the river, which seems to be a kind of a vain enterprise. And everything goes very slowly, and they're using blasting powder to blast through solid rock, and the blowers are getting killed or maimed, and it's all kinds of hassles. It floods. Washington goes and inspects the river work, and nothing's getting done, and it's quite frustrating. And in fact, it takes 17 years to finish the canal around Great Falls, by which time Washington has already died. So a lot of work goes into this plan.
Well, it did eventually get built, for at least a number of years, seemed to serve the purpose that he intended, although by that time there was competition from the railroads.
Yeah, people always talk about canals as though they were failures, and It's not true. Even the Potomac Canal, which is the one on the Virginia side of Great Falls, was not a failure. It worked for 30 years. For 30 years, it locked through many, many boats carrying heavy loads of coal and grain and flour and lime and pig iron and, you know, things that, I don't even know what pig iron is, but I mean, I think it has something to do with, I don't think it's a pig. I think it's a kind of iron.
Yeah.
Your callers, I mean, your listeners know. But yeah, he's carrying all kinds of stuff through the lock there. There's actually five locks, I think, at Great Falls. And it worked. It was an engineering marvel. People traveled from all over the Americas to see this. I mean, tourists from Europe would say, we got to go see the canal, because there was nothing else like it in the 1780s and 1790s in America of that scale. And so, and then when it opens up and it lasts until into the 1820s, but by that time, the decision is made by powerful elites in the Potomac area to build a continuous canal all the way along the river from Tidewater around Georgetown up to Cumberland, Maryland, which is 185 miles up the river. And then the idea is to keep going up the Potomac, across the mountains, and then down to the Ohio River, which was a canal that would have been hundreds and hundreds of miles long and would have had to raise flat water up to nearly 3,000 feet above sea level. They were going to have a little tunnel through there at some point, but the plans were for hundreds of locks lifting the canal boats up, and they were going to flood the meadows high in the Alleghenies and use those flooded meadows as the source of the water in the canal at the high elevation. So they had it was just a really tremendously ambitious project. They called it the Great National Project, and they finished about a third of it, and that was a pretty marvelous feat of engineering.
But about the time they did this, then, you know, there was also the first railroads coming into use.
Yeah, when it's the same day they broke ground on the C&O Canal, there was a cornerstone laid for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad, which was a very experimental technology in 1828, and was any rational person at the time would have said, no, canals are the way to go, because it's just so much easier to carry heavy loads on water, and railroads were just seemed kind of like a cockamamie notion where you'd pull something on rails behind a horse, because the locomotive had yet to be perfected in 1828. But eventually the railroads proved to be the better technology. They were more reliable year-round. It was much more of a year-round technology, and it was better at moving people more quickly. And eventually, they figured out how to carry heavy cargo, heavy freight on railroads, but the canals still worked. And if you had to pick the peak of the C&O Canal in terms of when it was carrying the most cargo, it was the 1870s. It was, you know, after the Civil War. So we're talking, you know, pretty late in the 19th century. It was still going strong, but the floods kept just wiping out the canal horribly. And the flood of 1889, which is the same flood that caused the Johnstown flood in Pennsylvania, that flood pretty much put the canal in you know, a serious hurt for a long time. And in 1924, the canal closed forever.
We just have about maybe 15 minutes left in this hour, and let me just mention again, our guest is Joel Achenbach. He's the author of the book, The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West. And it's a really great read, and we're talking about some of the stories that it contains. If you'd like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Stepping back a little bit in time to the period when George Washington was still alive, so if we sort of move past that, a lot of the great
we'll bring him back to life.
Okay, you write that Washington's crusade to impose order on this ragged and uncooperative world led him over the years to question the foundation of planter society, and that he grew to despise slavery. This is something I was very interested to read more about. I mean, he owned many slaves.
Yeah, since the age of 10, he was a slave owner when he inherited slaves from his father when his father died, and he grew up in a slave society. And it was Virginia was the population was something like 40% African American at that time, and he, Mount Vernon at its peak had more than 300 slaves. I mean, it essentially was a black community, you could almost say. I mean, he had some white servants and so on, but essentially, you know, what happened is he gradually came to see, I think during the Revolutionary War, that the institution was evil. And after the war, he started telling everyone, I don't want to be involved with this anymore. I think that this is, number one, I think he thought it was inhumane. And I think he also thought it was begging for trouble. I think he, like a lot of people, he feared slave insurrections. But I think he just sensed that it was something that, I mean, he didn't really say this is contradictory to the principles that the country was founded on, but certainly other people made that point. And he was so close to people like Lafayette, who, you know, believed in abolition, and Alexander Hamilton, who in the Chernow book makes clear was his entire life fiercely opposed to slavery. And so these are some of the closest associates of George Washington. So in the 1780s, he's growing away from the institution, and there apparently he got the idea that if he could sell all of his Western lands, he would have enough money to free not only his own slaves, but the so-called custis slaves, which were owned by his wife and the other heirs of Daniel Parke Custis. It's kind of a complicated matter, but the population in Mount Vernon has had two different populations of slaves, the ones that Washington owned and the ones that his wife owned. And he legally could not free the ones his wife owned, and even she would have problems doing so because they were still partly owned by the other heirs of Daniel Parke Custis, her first husband. In any case, famously in his will, he provided that his slaves be freed upon the death of his wife. And, you know, why did he stipulate it that way? Well, because he didn't want the slave families of the two populations to be broken up while his wife was still alive, because he knew it was going to be a very painful situation, which it turned out to be.
Mm-hmm. And he was one of these people that refused to separate the families, that he at least to the extent that he could control it.
Yes, he gradually, I mean, you know, it's, you don't want to apologize too much for his behavior, because, sure, you know, there's a lot of different ways to look at it. I mean, he could have done more, I think, than he did to use his influence to try to put America on the road to abolishing slavery. I think but at the same time, he was not known as a cruel master, and he did have principles that were laudable, such as he would not, he stopped selling slaves after the Revolutionary War. He wouldn't sell anymore. He did not want to break up families. He thought that was inhumane. I mean, obviously it was inhumane. I mean, you know, to rip a child or a husband or a wife away from the rest of the family. And so he did take a principled stand on that, unlike a number of other of his contemporaries. I don't know how much credit you give someone in that situation, and I think that if you look at, there's been a lot of good scholarship on this issue. The Roger Wilkins book is excellent, looking at, called Jefferson's Pillow, directly examines that whole question of how people today should view the slave owners of early American history. And then the definitive book recently is by Henry Winechet called An Imperfect God, which I think is a very fair look at the whole issue of Washington and slavery.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. A listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I've missed part of your show, so I hope I'm not too far off. But I guess I'd like you to just like to consider, you're talking about the founding principles of the democracy, and also maybe think about that in relation to principle in the sense of capitalism. And I'd kind of like to go back to just asking you, this push west, how was that different, you know, philosophically than the British colonization of North America or of India, or the use of slave labor in the triangular trade brought slaves to the South, as opposed to the, you know, I don't know whether to use the word decimation, that's not quite right, genocide, whatever, of the American Indians, and then this move toward imperialism, for example, in the Philippines?
Uh, I I think that there is, you know, an imperialist, you know, colonialist element to the push to the West. To say it's, you know, it's colonization of the West is not exactly right, in that Jefferson, for example, in designing the Northwest Ordinance, said that the states that would form in the West, in the Ohio Territory, the Northwest Territory, would be on equal footing with the states in the East, and that's why Ohio, Illinois, Indiana are, you know, were never colonies of the states to the East. But, you know, for all, you know, I mean, essentially you're correct. I mean, this was a aggressive and at times rapacious process that that led to the extermination of a lot of people. To call it genocide is, I think, it's a difficult thing, because it wasn't as though the goal was the extermination of the Indians, but in practical reality, what Washington believed was that the Indians would either have to become and adopt the ways of European Americans, or they would have to be exiled beyond the Mississippi. They were not part of his plan. I mean, nowhere in his plan was there a notion that you would have the long period of time territory that would be reserved for the Indians. There were various attempts to say, okay, everything north of the Ohio River is going to be reserved for the Indians. But if you read between the lines, it's clear that Washington is saying, inevitably, the European Americans, the whites, the Americans are going to be invading that territory, and we will eventually get that land. I mean, it's clear that they were not part of his plan, even though I think that on just sort of an individual level, he recognized and respected Indians more than a lot of people who were contemporaries of his, because he'd spent a lot of time with Native Americans as a young man, particularly. Had during the French and Indian War and during some of his early explorations and early surveying work, he was acquainted with them and spent a lot of time with them. I don't know that I've answered your whole question, though, about equating it with the British. I mean, yeah, it's the same thing. It is. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's a land grab. It's a rush to say that's going to be ours, and that is. You know, you can condemn it if you want to. It's the story of the last 500 years. Mm-hmm. That is what American history is based on, even before the United States existed. You can go back to the Spanish, the French. You know, there's always been this sense that this was a continent up for grabs, and George Washington had both feet in that whole process.
I just wanted to make that connection. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. We just have about 4 or 5 minutes left. I want to make sure to touch on a couple other things you write about in the book. Washington viewed the Potomac River as naturally the great uniter of the nation, but with the Civil War, it became the main line of division, in fact.
Yeah, the irony of the story. I mean, the Potomac isn't the tether, it's the fracture line. And during the Civil War, the Confederates were quite conscious that when they crossed the Potomac, they were invading the North. There were even some rebels who wouldn't go across the Potomac. They thought it was the wrong thing to do. But, yeah, there were several invasions of the North in 1862, 63, and 64. Famously, of course, the Gettysburg Campaign of 1863. And the Potomac, I mean, one thing I focus on is the one battle that happens on the Potomac itself, the Battle of Ball's Bluff, early in the war, which was powerful, I think, because you had soldiers, the Union was really badly defeated there, and a number of soldiers were drowned in the river and floated down the river and washed up on the banks of the Capitol, and it was kind of a signal, a really bad omen, that the war was going to last a long time. It would not be easily dispensed with as they'd hoped in 1861.
In the time, we just have about literally 2 or 3 minutes left, but let's talk about the Potomac River today. You say it failed to become what George Washington wanted it to be, and instead became something much better.
The Potomac today is a pretty natural river. You know, it has some pollution problems. It has, there's, you know, some places where you have, you know, millionaires have built mansions on the bluff above the river, or you have some factories here and there. But by and large, compared to most American rivers, it is you'd almost say a wild river. In fact, right near D.C., there's this gorge below Great Falls that's quite spectacular. And anyone who's had a chance to hike along the trails or paddle the river will appreciate it. I mean, even the U.S. Olympic kayaking team does a lot of kayaking right there in, you know, where Northwest D.C. meets Maryland. But so the river today it's really been well preserved in part by parkland, national park. The National Park Service owns a lot of the land along the river, and you know I think it's one of the real natural treasures and somewhat overlooked even in our area because so many people are oriented towards the urban elements of our existence. You know, and the Potomac is viewed as kind of a traffic obstacle. If you take the American Legion Bridge, which is part of the Capitol Beltway, you go over the river. You can barely even see the river because of the Jersey walls along the highway. So a lot of people just really don't know anything about it or which direction it flows or where it comes from. And part of my goal is to give people a better sense of place. And that applies not just to the Potomac, it's anywhere in America, a better sense of where you are and to think about how the landscape around you got to be that way.
And the canal that was for so many years was sort of dormant and neglected has been rehabilitated as a sort of a parkway?
The canal is, there are some parts of the canal that have water in them again, and it is a national park going all the way to Cumberland. It's 184 miles. It's a thin strip of parkland, and it's really an evocative trail. I hiked 100 miles along the towpath and really had a great time kind of imagining I was, you know, back in the 18th century. It's a pretty neat place.
Well, we're going to have to stop there. There's lots more in the book. The title is The Grand Idea, George Washington's Potomac and the Race to the West. The author is Joel Achenbach, A-C-H-E-N-B-A-C-H. He's staff writer for The Washington Post and author of the book. And Joel Achenbach, thanks so much for talking with us.
That was great. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
That's it for this hour of Focus 580. Time to hand things off to Celeste Quinn, host of the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, Jack. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with two journalists from the Boston Globe about John Kerry. Last summer, the paper put together an extensive series profiling the Democrat. The two reporters who will be our guests this afternoon were part of the team that reported, wrote, and edited that series and a book that has resulted from that series. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices on the board look lower at the moment. July wheat, 331.5, down 2.5. September, 339, down 2.5. July corn, 242.5, down 2.